Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. June is Pride Month for the LGBT community. And in Columbus, the weekend lineup of events includes a parade, a 5K, and much more. But healthcare is a year-round proposition, and that often is overlooked in the gay community for many reasons. In response, the Columbus Public Health Department has introduced a new LGBTQ advocacy position. Joining us by phone to explain why it's needed is Columbus Public Health Commissioner Dr. Teresa Long. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, and I'm glad to be with you, Ann.
And joining us in the studio is the new LGBTQ health advocate himself, Dwayne Stewart. Welcome to the show, Dwayne.
Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
Okay, so the Public Health Department already has a Latino advocate, a Somali advocate. What prompted the LGBTQ position, Dr. Long?
Yes, well, let me go there. Well, first of all, the mission of Columbus Public Health is to protect health and to improve lives in our community, and that means everyone and all lives. And we do have within our mission, our core values include equity and fairness. And so, indeed, we've had a longstanding interest as far as trying to broadly both understand and address health issues that our LGBTQ community face. And it's taken us a while to find some funding and then to find the right person. We think we've done that. So, again, we are committed to that our programs and services will be available and open, and that our staff will have the best understanding they can in working in the community and also in the provision of care. So this is really about understanding issues, about addressing the cultural competency issues, and, of course, addressing health disparities. And there are health disparities that our LGBTQ community face.
Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, sure. And, you know, this is no different than many others, many other communities. We are seeing that there are health disparities, and you mentioned our other health advocates as well. But clearly in the LGBT community, the issues such as breast and cervical and lung cancer, there is a disparity there. No doubt about HIV and AIDS, issues around depression and alcohol and drug addiction. There are significant needs and significant health disparities that exist in these areas.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, I'm talking with Dr. Teresa Long. She is the Columbus Public Health Commissioner. Also with us is Dwayne Stewart. He is the new LGBTQ health advocate for the City Health Department. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dwayne Stewart, tell us, you know, they said they finally found the right person for the job. What kind of person is needed for a job like this?
I think it's just someone who can speak to health advocacy issues within the LGBTQ community, and also someone who, you know, has connections throughout the community. The importance of this position is clearly needed. Like Dr. Long said, we have several health disparities, especially outside of HIV AIDS. And a lot of times sexual health is the point conversation when it comes to LGBT health. But we're definitely understanding through more research that that is not the case, that we are seeing disparities across the board. And that's important for us to address that.
Hey, Ann, can
sure.
I jump in there, too?
Absolutely.
And I apologize. You know, for instance, and I think what we are learning in all health issues, both in this community and around our country and around the globe, is that they're very complex issues, that it's not just the issue of an individual, but it's also about their context. You know, they're both their individual kind of behavioral factors that obviously go beyond our age and sex and hereditary and sexual orientation. So we're thinking also in all of our health areas around social and community networks, about the other kinds of socioeconomic and cultural and environmental issues. And just for instance, it is beyond. And many people might think that a public health agency like ours would simply stick with the HIV and AIDS work. It's very important to us. Chronic disease, both prevention and intervention, again, very important to us. But suicide, the suicide rate among the LGBTQ youth is 3 times that of the general population. And actually, when you look at some subsets, our transsexual, transgender youth, it doubles. So, again, we are not experts at Columbus Public Health in these issues, but we absolutely believe that we have expertise, and Duane's going to help us there, in both learning about these issues that people are really experiencing and then connecting, we hope, connecting whether it's outreach, engagement, other services that may well be able to assist both individuals and groups when these challenges are being faced.
Yeah, I don't want to oversimplify the mental health piece of this. These suicide rates speak for themselves, and the reasons behind those are very complex, but we know the isolation, the discrimination, and so forth, particularly among the youth. We know that, but there are some other big disparities that you mentioned in rates of breast and cervical cancer between straight and gay communities. Dr. Long, why is that? Do we have any sense about why that is?
Well, there's lots of reasons, and actually you did just mention stigma, though in a different way. Many of our LGBT community don't seek health care, and when they do, and we want them to seek health care, they don't feel comfortable in sharing with their provider lots about their lives. And so there are some assumptions made that may not be correct about what their risk factors may be or not be. And so what we find is there is less screening in some cases, whether, we just mentioned breast and cervical cancer. Some women don't believe that they're at risk. Well, that, of course, is not the case at all, or are not seeking active screening. And when they do, they're not necessarily feeling comfortable to be open and honest about both their behaviors, their risks or lack of risks, and, of course, the needs for whether it's mammogram, pap smear, et cetera. So there's there's both a human factor, there's a care and kind of the ability to be a culturally competent provider that really raises some of these issues and causes it drives these disparities.
So, Duane Steward, how does a health advocate go about addressing these kinds of disparities in the LGBTQ community?
Well, it's about advocacy. It's about education.
It sounds like myth busting.
Right, exactly.
Partly.
That's a very huge part of it. Last week, as a part of the Columbus Pride and their official film, I helped them show a film called You Not Alone that was about depression amongst Black gay men and the high rates of depression. It's specifically among Black gay men. And it's just about making the community aware of certain issues and how we can go about as a community coming together and figuring out some of these issues. It is about also making sure that our providers are culturally competent and going out into the community, talking with providers, training providers specifically on our issues so that they're able, when a LGBT person comes in their doors, they're able to set that person at ease that they are going to treat them just like anyone else and they are going to provide culturally competent care.
Yeah, I mean, it's just complicated by the whole idea that LGBTQ community has all the other communities in it as
right,
well.
Right, exactly. That's very true.
So there's a lot of crossover, perhaps, with what you do and what some of the other advocates do for the health department?
Yes.
Or some crossover?
Mm-hmm. I know Dr. Long mentioned this earlier about and you also, the other the other advocates at the mm-hmm. health department. I'm going to be working with them very closely in the Office of Equity and the Office of Minority Health at the health department is very committed to including the LGBT community in their work.
Dr. Long, of course, you know, carving out some money in the budget requires you to do some justification. How do you justify the expense? What's it costing us to not deal with these issues?
Well, obviously, there's both economic costs, but there are societal costs as well. So it really is thinking about how this community, and frankly, this community thinks of itself as smart and open and innovative. That's the spirit of Columbus that we're all talking about these days. And yet, if there is a large group in our community, and some say it's about 70,000, it may be well more than that, in our community that's feeling excluded or doesn't feel the full opportunity to receive health programming and health services that speaks to them, that's really important to deal with. So it's really, how could we not do this? And I think what we are going to find is is that Duane and all of us, because it's really not just about Duane. Mm-hmm. It's about us as an organization and then us as we work with our partners and with our residents as we try and spread the word that we hope that we will build a more open and understanding community where everyone has the opportunity to be healthy. And frankly, if the choices are hidden or excluded, if they are not available to people, you can't choose that opportunity to be healthy. And I know, Anne, you and I've talked about that before, and it applies in this situation to our community members who are in the LGBTQ community.
We're going to be talking about it later on this week because it is Pride Week, and you know, we always do a show about Pride Week. We're going to be talking about the violence issue. But that's another component. Bullying and violence is another component of what you do, Duane. How do you manage that?
Well, definitely, you know, violence and bullying, definitely we find lead often to health risk. And also, we definitely support Bravo, the Buckeye Region Anti-Violence Organization. When we heard about these issues and these anti-gay violence attacks in our city, and we reached out to Bravo, we very much support them. We've been distributing their safety information to the community, and we're also looking at ways that we can support their endeavors as they, you know, as they work on this process. We, of course, like you, wore pink on Friday to show our support at the health department.
It's like another myth that you have to bust. A lot of us feel like, wow, the HIV/AIDS thing is under control now. Mm-hmm. Not really.
Right.
And then also the danger, personal danger to people, because there's still people out there who would want to hurt them. That's not over with or eradicated either.
No, definitely not. We're definitely still, I mean, there was actually recently a report that just came out, I think it was just last week, that came out of the Pew Research Center that said 92% of Americans who are LGBT, they have reported that society is more accepting of them. But if you break that number down and go into that, about 40% say they have been rejected by family, 30% say they've been physically attacked, and we can go on and on and on. 30% say they've made to be feel unwelcome, 20% go on to say they've been treated fairly by an employer, and even almost 60% say they have at some point been targeted by slurs and jokes. And
all of that goes back to their health then eventually.
Right, exactly.
Right, Dr. Long?
Absolutely. And thanks for tying that back in, Anne. Absolutely. All of that. I mean, and again, you know, that 6 in 10 number that Duane, 58% of our LGBT communities across the country say they've been the target of slurs. And as we were thinking about this, it may be 100%, frankly, who have felt the being the target of this kind of stigma. And of course that impacts how you, it impacts your health, it impacts your mental health, it obviously impacts your behavior, and certainly about how you might seek health services as well. So there is a lot of work to be done, and you mentioned HIV and AIDS, and actually that continues to be an issue in this community. I think we've talked about it a little bit before, that indeed we've just reached a stage or a situation in this community where we are receiving new federal funds, considerable federal funds, to expand HIV.
Oops. Looks like Dr. Long, it sounds like we're starting to lose you. So I'm going to have to say goodbye now. I don't know what, there's some kind of...
Oh, she closed the door.
Oh.
Sorry, hold on.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
We're good.
Great. So suffice to say, Anne, there is a lot of work that needs to be done in trying to reach out to people to try and get them connected into care, and we're very committed to do that. You'll be seeing and learning more about that.
All right. Dr. Teresa Long, Columbus Health Commissioner, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks so much, Anne.
Also, Duane Stewart, the brand new LGBTQ health advocate at Columbus Public Health. Duane, thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you. And I just want to lastly mention that we are going to be having an event tonight about cultural competency in the LGBT community at the health department. Make sure you guys out there join us at 4:30.
All right, we'll try to get a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Member contributions are the largest source of funding for 89.7 NPR News. Your support provides for the highest quality news and information. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we still have about $50,000 to raise. You can help us meet our annual goal by giving at WOSU.org or by calling 866-897-9678. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
It's the return of the original, highly acclaimed series, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Watch Sherlock Holmes and the Norwood Builder Thursday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new survey has revealed that Ohio has a dental problem that is a major shortage of dentists, especially in rural communities. According to the Dental Access Now campaign, almost 340,000 Ohio kids have never been to the dentist. And almost 45% of adults have had permanent teeth removed because of tooth decay. Joining us now, we hope, is to talk about that shortage is the project director for Dental Access Now at UCAN Ohio, David Mayware. We're working on getting him on the phone right now.
I'm here, Ann.
Oh, hi, David. Thanks.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Looking at the map of Ohio counties with dental shortages, the Appalachian region of the state looks worst off. First of all, what constitutes a shortage?
Well, one of the things that communities can do as they recognize that there is a growing access to dental care shortage is to make an application to the Ohio Department of Health. Once that application goes in, the Ohio Department of Health takes the community through a very rigorous set of questions. Questions like, are there dentists who are willing to take Medicaid? Are there dentists who are willing to work with folks who are low income? What's the poverty population in the community? And after that process happens, a designation called Health Professional Shortage Area is applied to the community. It's not always a county. Sometimes it's part of a community. For instance, there are two health professional shortage areas in Columbus. And in other cases around the state, it's a whole county that is designated as a health professional shortage area. When I started the project, the Dental Access Now project for UCAN Ohio, 2 years ago, there were 59 health professional shortage areas where there just aren't enough dentists to take care of the people who need their care, who are Medicaid patients. Now we're at 79 communities or counties across the state.
Is that a lot? Is that a lot? Does Ohio not look? What does Ohio look like in terms of that?
You know, there are other states in the union that have more health professional shortage areas, but just think about the fact that within a very short period of time, we went from 59 communities and counties to now 79. It's not so much a growth in the issue of people who are growing in numbers, although that's true,
mm-hmm.
it's also just the fact that more communities are becoming aware of the reality of lack of access to care, dental care, and then the relationship to overall health care creates other kinds of problems for consumers.
So what do residents of Lawrence County, obviously in the rural areas of Lawrence County, which is most of Lawrence County, for example, do when their teeth, when they need dental work? Where do they go? How do they get it? Anywhere?
Well, they may seek help at a local free clinic or a health or a federally qualified health center that may provide dental care. If they can't find the care there, they're going to travel great distances. They'll go to the next place, another community that may have a dental clinic available. They may go online and find out about what's called the Options Program, which attempts to link dentists who are willing to do free or low-cost care to individuals. And in some cases, they end up at the emergency room. And when that happens, what they typically get is an assessment that says, yes, indeed, you have an abscess tooth and an infection. They get a prescription for an antibiotic, and they get maybe a prescription for a painkiller. And then they get a list of places that they can go to get their tooth taken care of, which may be the same places that they tried to get into before. So it's a very intense, vicious cycle that folks go through.
Right, because if they could just have regular dental visits,
right,
they often wouldn't get to that point of an abscess in the first place.
That's the key to the problem that Ohio faces. It's not the need for more single-day emergency extraction clinics. It is that people in all across Ohio need to have regular checkups by a dentist, which means they have to have a dentist nearby that they can travel to like most of us do. I mean, my dentist is downtown here in Columbus, so I can walk to his office.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have to take a day off from work in order to get to Columbus to Children's Hospital where there's a dental clinic or to OSU where there's a dental clinic, it means that it interferes with my work and then my earnings.
So what's the problem? Why aren't there dentists in the rural areas? I mean, why is there such a shortage now?
We've heard several different reasons for the shortage that exists in rural areas. One of them is that dentists come out of school with a very high loan repayment that they need to take care of. So they're going to have to go where they know they can make money. The other kinds of problems are that the Medicaid program reimburses at about 32 or 33% of the usual going rate for dental procedures. Mm. So the reimbursement rate is low. We've also heard that the bureaucracy within the Medicaid program is very difficult to navigate. So, you know, there are some structural problems that are there. But the reality is that there just aren't enough dentists who are coming out of school, seeing that they have a public health commitment to provide good oral health care, and looking for a community like one in Lawrence County where they can set up shop and do business.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. One possible alternative, I think it's been happening in other states, are a different standard of caregiver. It's a registered dental practitioner. Do they exist in Ohio now, and how would they help if we had them?
It's not a different standard of care. It's actually a different professional providing a different kind of care.
I think I get different category of professionals.
Correct.
Right? Yes.
Correct.
Thanks.
What the registered dental practitioner would be educated to do would be to provide some extraction, some drilling and filling, and just as important, community education for folks who have grown up hearing, you know, the myths about we're all going to lose our teeth, so we don't need to take care of them. There really needs to be folks, boots on the ground, who are working with people, consumers in all of Ohio's communities to help them understand the link between oral health care and overall health care. Right. So, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because it's not just about keeping your teeth. Oral health care affects it. You can die.
That's right. In fact, we have had folks die here in Ohio. Kyle Willis was a young man who had an abscess, tried to get it taken care of, couldn't find access to care in Southwest Ohio, and as a result of that, he did die. And we don't know how many other folks out there have happened to, but we do know that it has happened. And what we also need to establish clearly is the link between the potential risk of heart attack, of strokes, of increased risk of to your diabetes, We now also know, because of research, that moms who are carrying babies have the potential of having low birth weight babies or preterm babies. So it affects every age of our lives.
Another important role for dentists is something that you may not even notice during your regular checkup, and that is a screen for cancer. The National Institutes of Health predict that this year, more than 40,000 people will be diagnosed with some kind of oral cancer, most of them treatable when caught early, and most of them, or many of them, caught by dentists. Joining us now by phone from her busy Westerville dental practice is Dr. Lynn Monstwill. Welcome to the show. Lynn should be on the air. Lynn?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us about the screen and tell us what part of the examination is the screening.
Well, when we see our patients, we recommend that they come in 2 times every year for a dental cleaning and a regular examination. And at that time, we examine the patient's teeth for dental caries and their gum tissue for any signs of periodontal disease. At that time, we also perform an oral, head, and neck cancer exam for every patient that we see.
And what does that involve?
That involves looking and feeling all of the tissues in and around the oral cavity, including the neck, the back of the throat, and observing all of the hard tissues on our regular dental x-rays.
When did this become a normal part or a routine part of an examination?
Well, I've been practicing dentistry for 17 years now, and it's always been a routine part of my practice.
Mm-hmm. How common is it for a dentist to screen, to pick up something? Is it typically a dentist that does it?
It is typically a dentist. A dentist is the most familiar with the hard and soft tissue around the head and neck, and so they're probably the most trained to help detect those kinds of concerns.
Paul in Pomeroy, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hello, thank you.
You're from a rural area, right?
Yes, Meigs County here.
And there's a shortage there?
I would say so.
How does it affect life there?
Well, it just costs too much. Basically, people don't go because it just costs too much. I guess the thing, I'm able to do it, but most people are not able.
Meaning?
I'm just thinking there's not enough dentists. I mean, there's not.
Okay. We have just lost the caller. We are losing our lines for some reason, listeners, and I apologize for that. That's why there's a little bit of back and forth here. David Mayware, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. Just keeps dropping off. As far as dentists and so forth and screening for cancers and that sort of a thing, is that something that pops up on your radar screen?
Yes, it is. I mean, the screening for all forms of problems in the mouth is really critical. And I'm glad that Dr. Monstwill is on the phone, because part of what we really need to do is a community education effort to make sure that people know and understand that they have to get regular checkups, because it's more than just brushing your teeth and flossing. It is that there's an oral cavity there that can be filled with all kinds of problems.
Dr. Monstwill, can you talk a little bit about the most common kinds of oral cancer and maybe what people can look for themselves? We don't have Dr. Monstwill. Okay, well, let's just put her on. I guess they're not going to put her on the air for some reason, David Mayware.
You know, part of what you're doing right now, Anne, is really critical. And anybody who is listening to this show should look at themselves and look at their family and really take stock in how important it is to make sure that you get into the dentist. And if you can't get to the dentist, then you should do what the gentleman from Pomeroy did. Pick up the phone and let somebody know. this is a public health crisis that we're dealing with, and we have public officials and public policymakers who right now are making a determination about the state's budget. Call your legislator. Say to your legislator, this is a problem. It's not hidden. It's out in the open, and it's killing people.
Dr. Montswell, are you with us?
Yes.
Sorry about that. But I did want to ask you, as far as self-care goes, for people who are in these remote areas, they're having a hard time getting to a dentist. Can you give us some tips about what they might look for if they see something funny in their mouth that might be a predictor of something they should seriously get checked up on?
Certainly. You know, one of the things with oral cancer is that it may go undetected by the patient because in its early stages, they may not experience any symptoms. They may not experience any of the pain or swelling that may be associated with it. And that's why early detection saves lives in oral cancer cases. But some of the things that they can look for are any masses or lumps in their throat or anywhere in their mouth, sores or lesions in their mouth that do not heal within 2 weeks' time, a lump or thickening in their cheeks, white or red patches on their gums, tongue, tonsils, or any of the linings of their mouth, any difficulty chewing or swallowing or moving their jaw or their tongue. And those are some of the things that they can look for.
Okay. And then, David Mayweather, just one more question, getting back to the idea of a registered dental practitioner. It would be like a nurse practitioner. And I wanted to be clear. Do they exist now in Ohio?
The position doesn't exist in Ohio. Right. The closest state would be Minnesota.
Okay. And you mentioned the legislature. Are there bills pending? Has this been introduced? Would it be a legislative issue?
It is a legislative issue because it would require a change in the scope of practice. There hasn't been a piece of legislation introduced, and that's part of the reason that we are asking folks to call their legislators.
All right. Okay. Well, David Mayweather and also Dr. Lynn Montswell, thank you so much for your patience today. Appreciate your contribution.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Coming up, we have more Wellness Wednesday. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the background behind the secret surveillance programs leaked by Ed Snowden. We'll talk about programs collecting metadata, the laws that govern those programs, and the questions those programs raise about privacy with journalist Shane Harris, the author of a book about the rise of America's surveillance state. He covers intelligence for Foreign Policy magazine. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Thursday night, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes returns to WOSU-TV. Jeremy Brett and David Burke star as the great detective and his friend Watson in the original, highly acclaimed series. This week, when a notorious retired builder is found dead, his recently named heir is the prime suspect, but Holmes is certain of his client's innocence. Watch Sherlock Holmes and the Norwood Builder Thursday night at 10 on WOSU-TV. Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 partners. Visit wosu.org/membercard.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've all heard the expression, give till it hurts. Well, there's evidence to suggest that perhaps a more accurate expression would be give till it heals. A recent study published in the American Journal of Public Health found that providing, not receiving, financial support can help you live longer. Joining us to talk about that and more is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Center. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning. Thank you.
So this study in the Wellness Letter that was written about in the Wellness Letter, it involved about 850 people over the age of 65 who were interviewed about stressful events they had experienced and about how much they had helped others. But the study was pretty complex. Can you tell us about it?
It was. It was a really interesting study that looked at a population, as you were saying, of people who have been under a great deal of stress and the caregivers for those people. When I say caregivers, it looked at people who were providing transportation, doing errands for them, shopping for those people, performing housework, performing childcare, just helping people who were having a difficult time with life. But instead of looking just at the people who were having the difficult time at life, the study also looked at the people who were giving that care. And what was really interesting about the study was that the people giving that care received an enormous amount of benefit in terms of psychologically, sure, they felt like they were helping these people and it felt good in terms of altruism, but it also paid off in terms of their health. When they looked at the mortality over the next 5 years of those caregivers, it was much lower than a control group of people. So there's something about giving help that helps you.
Yeah, I wasn't sure whether it was something like giving money. We always say it feels good. You know, we tell people, give to public radio. You're going to feel better. Does it have anything to do with that, where just the actual mental gesture of the gift of help is something physiological?
Well, this particular study didn't look at that, but there have been other studies that have looked at giving help in a more general way or a less direct way, and those studies have hinted at the same thing. There's a long literature now on this idea that social determinants of health play an enormous role in how well we do. What I mean by that is how well we feel connected to our society, how well we're working with other people seems to have a tremendous salutary effect on our health as well.
Okay, so if I serve lunch at a soup kitchen, does it lower my blood pressure directly, or does it make me feel happy, get me to exercise? Do they control for that in the study?
They did control for all of those things, and the answer is yes to all of those things. I think the way to look at this is that we need to recognize that giving gives back, or this idea that the phrase that we've heard forever, and that is what goes around seems to come around. Mm-hmm. We're social animals, and the more we socially interact, the more we interact positively with our fellow person, it seems to come back to us in terms of a lot of benefits, including health benefits.
Okay, so moving on, there was some, well, I don't know, one of my producers called it bad news for hummus lovers. It's more like medium news or something. You wrote about it recently in the newsletter. Apparently a much-lauded Spanish study which found that the Mediterranean diet, the one we all love to eat, caused a 30% reduction in heart attacks and strokes, but you found, or it's been found, that perhaps that study was somewhat flawed.
Well, it wasn't so much that it was flawed, but I think the way it was translated to the public was flawed. We put a lot of effort into looking at the study very, very carefully. And what turned out was something we've known for a long time. We learned it from people who live on the island of Crete many decades ago, and that is people who eat the, quote, Mediterranean diet seem to get health benefits from it, and they seem to live longer and have fewer medical problems. That was found in this study, and that was not surprising. I think the way it was translated is what was disappointing, and that is that the study, yes, affirmed the Mediterranean diet. It further affirmed that olive oil seems to be very healthful. It also affirmed that eating nuts seems to be very helpful. But what it didn't really address adequately was, how does this diet compare to the low-fat, healthful diet, for example, as advocated by the American Heart Association? And it really couldn't do that. And I think that was what was lost in the translation.
So what accounted for the 30% reduction in strokes and heart attacks?
Well, they looked at three groups. They looked at one group of people who were put on the Mediterranean diet, and they were told to eat extra olive oil. The second group was put on the Mediterranean diet, and they were given nuts to eat, so they ate extra nuts every day. And the third group was told to be on a low-fat diet that would theoretically be somewhat comparable to the American Heart Association low-fat diet. What it turned out, though, was that that last group was almost identical in terms of how they eat. This was done in Spain, by the way. And so these were all Spanish people. These were all people with high blood pressure, with diabetes, and other risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So they were a high-risk group. But it was that third group, the group that was told to eat a low-fat diet, but not given the extra nuts and not given the extra olive oil. It turned out that group really ate a diet almost identical to the two other groups. And it was in that particular group that had the higher cardiovascular complication rate. So that's a long way of saying, Ann, that we really can't say that they were on a low-fat diet, because they really weren't. So it wasn't really what the American Heart Association advocated.
So it makes you curious, though, about what were they doing differently?
It does make one curious. The study was really well designed, and it was well carried out. We don't know what that factor or what those factors are that made the difference. Some people have wondered about the olive oil. The olive oil group, for example, had one tablespoon a day more than the low-fat group. So not a lot more olive oil, but more.
Mm-hmm.
It was extra virgin olive oil. Did that make a difference? What about the nuts? They had a few more nuts in the nut group than the control group, but not a lot more. It was like somewhere between 0.3 and 0.4 extra servings. So not a lot. So we don't know, did nuts make the difference or not? Further, the diet really wasn't compared to some of the things that others have advocated. For example, how would the Mediterranean diet hold up against a strict vegetarian diet? How would it hold up against a traditional Asian cuisine diet? How would it hold up against a diet very, very low in fat, as advocated by Dean Ornish? So those are questions that really still remain. I think the bottom line to this, the take-home message, is that there's something very healthful in the Mediterranean diet. And I would suggest that, as opposed to wondering what that one magic bullet might be, it may be the whole diet. And that is, if you're going to eat a lot of fats, which these folks did, they got somewhere around 40% of their calories are fats, they should be in the form of these polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fats. So like olive oil, the monounsaturated fat, and in nuts, which have a lot of fat in them, but they're polyunsaturated. Eat a balanced diet. It should be heavily influenced by fish. It should have a lot of fiber in it. It perhaps should have some wine in it, although it's not clear that that would make the difference, but perhaps it should, and perhaps it should be red wine. Clearly, people who have the Mediterranean diet have a different lifestyle than we do. That is, maybe the traditional lifestyle calls for more walking, which appears to be the case. And maybe that plays a major role. So I think the take-home message is, eat a diet that's high in fiber, that's rich in plant foods, that maybe has a little wine, that has some olive oil, and heavier in fish and less in, for example, a lot of meats that Americans tend to consume. And make sure you combine that with physical activity. I think that's, if you do all those things, that's probably where you can get the most health benefit from a diet.
Before we move on, could you explain, Dr. Swartzberg, why red wine, why not white wine?
Well, I can't really explain it because it's not absolutely clear that that's the case.
Okay.
There are some polyphenols, chemicals in red wine that aren't present in white wine, and there's at least test tube data and some data in humans that may make a difference between the two. But most of the studies have shown that it's probably the alcohol that makes the big difference. That is, alcohol itself may have, in very modest doses, mm-hmm. may have a salutary effect on our health. So I think that it's probably the alcohol. There may be a little bit added on by the red wine, but that's a little less clear.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we have a return guest, Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board at the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment for him about our topics today, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So before you joined us, we were talking about oral cancer screenings. And in the Wellness Letter, there's an article about diabetes screenings. There seems to be some disagreement about who should get tested. What difference does it make?
Well, that's a really important question. That is, people have raised the question, is there a value to being screened for diabetes to identify diabetes earlier and get you on either lifestyle interventions or medications earlier?
You mean before you have symptoms?
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, I may feel fine going to my doctor, and my doctor tells me my blood sugar is high, I have diabetes. And I say, well, I feel fine. And my doctor would tell me, well, look at here are the things you need to change in your lifestyle. You need to exercise more. You need to eat better. You may need to lose some weight. And if you do all those things, you may or may not need medication. Or it may turn out I would do all those things and I'd need medication. And I'd still be asymptomatic. I'd feel fine. Would it make any difference if I waited 10 more years, for example, and was now symptomatic from the diabetes and then did the lifestyle modifications and then took the medications? Now, common sense would say it makes sense to attack this as early as possible. What's lacking is a lot of good science to support that conclusion. And so right now we have, for example, the American Diabetes Association that is a strong proponent of screening just about everybody beginning around age 45, unless you're at high risk. For example, if you're in an ethnic group that has a higher risk for diabetes, like blacks and Hispanic, some Asians and Native Americans, or if you have high blood pressure or a low HDL cholesterol, or if you have high triglycerides or a strong family history of diabetes or cardiovascular disease, you need to start earlier than 45. That's the American Diabetes Association. The United States Preventive Services Task Force, which evaluates medical matters, said that the only data that argues for screening asymptomatic people is if you have high blood pressure. And so that's their recommendation. The Canadian Task Force on Preventive Health makes a more vague statement saying only screen people who are fairly high risk for diabetes, that list I gave you before.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you've got, besides the American Diabetes Association, there are a lot of major health organizations that call for screening. There was a large study in Lancet, a prestigious British medical journal, last year that looked at an enormous amount of people. They looked at a randomized trial on 15,000 people aged 40 to 69. And these people were at high risk for diabetes. And when they followed up 10 years later, it didn't seem to matter whether they were diagnosed earlier or later. So it's a very confused field. I think right now, the position that we took at the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter, and I think is really reasonable, is to follow mostly what the American Diabetes Association says. And that is, I think it probably does matter, even though we don't have the data, that we should screen earlier and try and identify people. After all, if I'm overweight and I don't eat a healthful diet and I've got a little high blood pressure and I find out I have diabetes, and that may be the thing to spur me to lose the weight, eat a healthier diet, and bring my blood pressure down, well, that's going to help me no matter what. So I think right now, even though we don't have the data to argue strongly for it, I think screening remains a very good idea.
When we're talking about diabetes being at it's getting to become an epidemic level because of the obesity problem in this country, are we getting those numbers from all of these screenings that are being done?
That's a great question, and the answer is yes. The definition of diabetes is a laboratory test showing you have a blood sugar higher than a certain level consistently, and if you do, you have diabetes whether or not you're symptomatic.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. So, you know, there's still hope then. It's not maybe quite as gloomy as it sounds. It could be better, and that just means knowing what your health situation is and adjusting.
Yeah. Yeah, I would probably look at it a little differently and
okay.
say that I'm still think this the future is pretty gloomy
okay.
in terms of the increasing number of people with diabetes.
Yes.
But that said, you're absolutely right. Maybe it's not quite as gloomy.
Yeah, not quite as gloomy, but but at least it's a sign of something that should be considered and looked at and taken care of, and you should be aware of it.
I really think so. And I think that even though we don't have the data, as I said, I think it's really worthwhile.
Now, I have to ask you about another article in the Wellness Letter that we didn't plan on, but I just have to ask you about the 5-second rule. I couldn't believe it when I read that in the last word that you guys wrote about the 5-second rule.
Yeah, well, it... apparently, there's no 5-second rule. This is the bottom line.
So if you drop yeah. something on the floor and you, you know, count to five, picking it up does not guarantee that you're safe.
That's right. But I would just add to that that floors certainly are not clean, but they may not be the most dangerous thing to drop food on.
Okay.
For example, your kitchen counter may even be more dangerous in terms of pathogens. So, yeah, no 5-second rule, and there's no safe place to drop it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. John Swartzberg, for joining us again. We really appreciate it.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board at UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. If you want to listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher, you can catch up. Learn more about it at WOSU.org/allsides. From our website, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon. You can also explore the All Sides archive, which includes audio, video, and podcasts of every show. That's at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to the All Sides staff, includes producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Shannon Clary, and Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Jochi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Ann, on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.
Support comes from TEDx Columbus, seeking ideas, discoveries, and personal stories that are out there and worth sharing at its official open call auditions on June 19th. The winning auditions will appear at the 5th TEDx Columbus Conference this fall. Details at TEDxColumbus.com.